Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's episode of Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. In this hour, we'll be talking with Ed Clancy about, firstly, how the Indian Supreme Court has declared that anti-conversion laws may be deemed unconstitutional. The Constitution of India becomes its Magna Carta, if you will, for the determination of what laws at the level of the state are deemed valid or not. And there have been numerous states in India that have espoused non-conversion laws, when it comes to religions, particularly from Hinduism to Christianity. And so Catholics in India have been experiencing in these areas true persecution. But there seems to be a turn in the tide, and therefore there seems to be hope for the future. And then from there, in the second and third segments, we will be talking about Winston Churchill, his life and his faith. Winston Churchill was not particularly known as a man of deep Christian faith. In fact, there are times where he was described as a God-haunted man. Sometimes he's described as a stalwart non-believer. And yet, dancing between these two extremes was a man whose heart was firmly set on Judeo-Christian heritage, biblical truths, and most of all, the constant establishment of the right and dignity of the human person as metaphysical, and therefore he abhorred a materialistic society. And we're going to talk about his legacy and also his contribution to this historical event today, which is the 80th anniversary of the storming of the beaches of Normandy on what we now remember as D-Day or Operation Overlord. Operation Overlord, David Kennedy once wrote that it was the long-awaited mother of battles and perhaps history's most prolific womb of war stories. It was a symbol of American commitment to freedom and service to the other, American power, ingenuity, cohesion, audacity, but also industrial supremacy. And because of that, it will go on in our history as a great success, but also an event of true sacrifice. And we'll be talking about all of that in the second and third segment. So stay tuned as we continue these conversations. For now, let's take a look at the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, June 6th. It's the Feast of St. Norbert. And today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. The U.S. congressional representatives are in Normandy, France today to honor the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Among them is a group of lawmakers who previously served in the military and who are parachuting out of a World War II era plane, just as Allied airborne forces did in 1944. Lawmakers participating in the jump include Representatives Daryl Issa of California, Dan Crenshaw of Texas, Corey Mills of Florida, and several others. Pope Francis will be taking an 8-week break in his liturgical schedule this year. According to a schedule that was published this week, Francis doesn't have any public masses on his schedule from July 8th to September 1st. This comes as Francis is getting ready for his international trips in September. He's scheduled to visit Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, Singapore, Belgium, and Luxembourg. A rare Star Wars action figure is sold for a record-breaking $525,000. Heritage Auctions announced Monday that the Boba Fett action figure sold on May 31st is now the world's most valuable vintage toy. The 1979 rocket-firing Boba Fett came with a little plastic missile, but the toy never hit shelves because it was feared the missile could become a choking hazard. Some of the toys survived and have been in high demand by collectors. Last week's winning bid broke the record for a vintage toy, previously held by a diamond-wearing Barbie doll that sold for $300,000 in 2010. and Caitlin Clark's popularity is influencing baby names. A new report from website Baby Center shows the name Caitlin is up almost 1,600 spots as a girl's name, and Clark is up 15 spots as a boy's name. The former Hawkeye basketball star, now with the WNBA's Indiana Fever, was selected as the WNBA's Rookie of the Month in May. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Catholics in India have expressed optimism following the Supreme Court's recent comments that a draconian anti-conversion law may be found to violate the Indian Constitution. We are joined by Ed Clancy, who is Director of Outreach for Aid to the Church in Need. And you can visit his work at churchinneed.org. Ed, great to have you in the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, on May 16th, there was a hearing in the Supreme Court pertaining to an anti-conversion law in the northern Uttar Pradesh state. And this is draconian. There's no way around it. This is unjust. But it's great that the Supreme Court has acknowledged that this is unconstitutional.
Yes, no, it's an area of India, the northeast part of India, which was one time called the Seven Sisters. It is a region of India that back in 1951 or 52 was designated as sort of a no-touch, you know, a no-contact zone for anybody outside of the people living in the region. And at that time, the very secular, non-religious government of India established rules that said that there was no proselytization allowed in there. Now, when you fast forward to the recent anti-conversion laws under Modi and his predecessors, there were these laws put into effect which essentially allowed retribution against any person or any people involved with the conversion of a person, of another person, mm-hmm. another individual. So free will was removed completely. And the punishments of what was put in place essentially guaranteed that the minority religions would have essentially no ability to evangelize, to essentially exist out in public.
Right. And it presents a problem even on a governmental level, because the Indian Constitution is inherited from the Magna Carta, the principles of the Magna Carta at the very least. Mm-hmm. And its system of government is inherited from British civil government, parliamentary system. So in that light, the fact that such a law was even allowed to function presents itself as a fundamental breach in the right of freedom of conscience.
Oh, most certainly. So this India is just one example of probably, somewhere between 25% and 30% of all the countries in the world that have similar rules, which restrict the freedom of religion, the freedom of thought, the freedom of belief. And what this does is it undermines the basic identity of a person. Because if you cannot decide what you believe or who you believe in, you lose the fundamental characteristic of the human, and it makes you even more essentially chattel than person.
Right. Right, exactly. And therein lies a major issue of contention, because we're not talking about forceful proselytization at the threat of life. We're talking about the freedom of one's conscience to determine for themselves where they put their center of faith. And it's horrific to think about the fact that of India's 28 states, 12 of them have such laws.
Yeah, and again, if we look at the history of the northeast part of India, it is very telling. So the area of India, that area of India was native tribes. They were in the news last year with the Nagas and the Kiku and the Maitai, who were battling amongst each other. Mm-hmm. And for most people in the United States and the West, these names sound very, very odd and, unusual. But the simple fact of the matter is, if you look at Christianity in India, it represents about 2% of the total population. But if you go into up to Arunachal Pradesh, 30% of the population is Christian, mm-hmm. more than there are Hindus. So what happened in that region? was when these laws were put into effect, essentially started in the 1950s and then sort of exacerbated recently. They started restricting any work in that area. And then there's a bishop up there, Bishop George Padapalil, who, as a seminarian, noticed in the area of Assam that there were these native tribal children coming down into Assam, an area that was developed and had the tea industry. And they saw these scrawny, naked children coming, and oftentimes they were preyed upon by the local population. So he and some of his fellow seminarians began helping them, putting them in either the girls living, the sisters in the convent, and the boys living among the Salesians nearby. And so they took them in, took care of them, and within a year or two, they were learning to read, they were learning to write, they're eating regular meals.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to go back and tell their families up in the northeast part of India about what had happened to them and to introduce the idea of Christianity, believe it or not. And when they went back up there, this is an area that had headhunting. That literally there was human sacrifice going on up until, you know, within the last 50 years. These children went back, and when the tribal leaders saw that they were 6 inches or more taller than their fellow, you know, classmates, we'll call them, they were amazed. And so at that time, the warring factions literally stopped because these children came back, and each tribal leader was saying, what's happening here?
Mm.
And the children would speak about Jesus. And, of course, they were very practical to say, well, if Jesus makes you look like this and makes you stronger and better, I want to know about Jesus. And just to give you a little idea of what it's like up there, Mother Teresa, who was in India since 1929, spent 50 years trying to get up into that northeast part of India.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of India, you literally need a passport. Even with a citizenship or a passport from India, you need a visa in order to go into that region.
Right.
And there's a little story about Mother Teresa. In 1994, she was supposed to come to World Youth Day in Denver. She skipped the trip because an opportunity opened for her to visit. And she said that she would much rather go there than World Youth Day. And it was a great opportunity because what happened was when Mother Teresa went, she did not get the invitation from the states or from the federal government of India. She got it from the tribal leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Her and her sisters went to the border without a visa. The border guards were there and saying, I'm sorry, we can't let you in on a visa. But they were met by something like 20,000 tribal people standing behind the small contingent of federal agents. And they realized, we're not going to stop this. So Mother Teresa made her one and only trip in 1994 into that area of India. And just to give you an example of what has happened there, and this is, again, one of the reasons why these draconian laws were put into effect, is because Christianity has grown so much in that region, it is now over, even growing faster than Hindu, Islam, or any other.
Right.
As I mentioned, Arun Kavpradesh, which is the northernmost of the states and very close to the border of China, has 30%+ Christians and only 26% Hindus.
Mm.
So this is a threat. And when the especially nationalist government sees this, they do everything they can to stop it. And last year in Manipur, there was an attack in the village areas of Nagaland. And it was the Hindu nationalist-backed, Nagas, who were fighting the Kikuyu. And they literally were raiding, destroying churches in the area. In fact, 250 churches, Christian churches, were destroyed during this time. And the government, and as in most of these cases, gave lip service and did nothing more before they finally had to come in and do something because of the amount of violence. The bishop up there was sending us pictures of horrible atrocities of what was happening to the people, the natives, these poor Christian, especially women.
Wow, and all of this is surprising for on a lot of levels. One of the main reasons is the fact that the Supreme Court, at the very least orally, commented that these anti-conversion laws in Uttar Pradesh are violative of the Constitution. But on the other hand, the fact that over 30% of the population of Uttar Pradesh is Christian, while it is ruled by the pretty totalitarian Hindu nationalist BJP. So the ruling faction cannot be pleased by that.
No, not at all. And in fact, I think in the most recent election, again, you know, speculation on many parts, we're seeing the effects of this. We saw that the Modi government, the BJP, lost somewhere between 25 and 30% of their seats. They lost the absolute majority. They're forced to enter into a unity government with other parties. So you see that there's a slow erosion of this. And so these regions like the northeast part of India, the other thing that is happening is obviously part of the appeal of BJP was the fact that they were moving up in the economic world and they were becoming more sort of involved in a lot of industries and with economic growth. But what was happening was that the lower levels of society were suffering or are suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the northeast part of India, literally, we're talking about 50 years ago, headhunting and cannibalism. You know, you had, as I mentioned about those children coming in malnourished and old, very ill health, and being aided by, of all things, Christianity, right? So, again, when you have that and you have this underpinning, if you remember a few years ago, the government was so strict that they actually shut down the ability of Mother Teresa's charity, the missionaries of charity in India, from collecting funds and distributing funds because of these rules. Now, they've been doing this consistently. And I think you can do that so much before people start realizing, wait a second, the church is serving everyone. The church, the Christian community, is helping all people, and especially the poorest of the poor. And these are the people that have been most affected by this economic growth of the upper sector of the India economy. And so, again, just away from all the legal portions of this, you have a situation where the justices are not blind. They see what's going on in society. And they really, I think, from a point of conscience, have to look at it and say, at the very least, we should have the courage to tell the truth, which hasn't happened in the past. Oftentimes, there's been this sort of negligence of veracity.
Yeah. And it really is startling that the BJP has gotten away with a lot of what they've done, especially with these non-conversion laws, anti-conversion laws, considering that, like we've just seen Article 25 of their constitution being pretty explicit about freedom of conscience. But the fact of the matter is the enactment of the constitution on a federal level in India is difficult because of differing ruling factions in each state.
Yeah. And again, a lot of this goes back to, you know, India is a relatively young country. Some of our, countries in the West. I mean, they only exist for, say, 170.
Ed, we're going to have to take a break there. We're hitting a hard break. My guest, Edward Clancy, Director of Outreach for Aid to the Church in Need. And we've been talking about anti-conversion laws in India being unconstitutional. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Did you know everything about Catholic family life is a prayer? Because of sacramental grace, when families do all the normal things we already do, but do them with the intention of sharing Christ's love with each other, we're praying. When you hug your kids, hold them an extra second and give them a hug from God, too. When you make a meal, ask the Blessed Mother to help you make it in the same spirit she served her son. When you discipline your kids, take a moment to pray together and ask God to help you learn to take even better care of each other. Inviting God's grace into everything we do is how normal, messy families become real domestic churches. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Which of the seven sacraments has been especially instituted by Christ to aid those who are being tried by serious illness? It is the sacrament called the anointing of the sick. This sacrament was particularly promulgated by the Apostle James, who said, "Is anyone among you sick? Let him call the priests of the church, and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith will save the sick man, and the Lord will raise him up, and if he has committed sins, he will be forgiven." Over the centuries, the sacrament came to be used on those who were dying and was called extra unction. But in this day and age, it is seen not as a sacrament strictly for those who are near death, but also those who are gravely ill, in the hope they will recover. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism. Thank you for listening.
At EWTN Radio, your family. And because you're a part of our family, we value your opinions on what you hear on EWTN. You can call our listener comment line 24/7 at 205-795-5773. We value your comments, your questions, and any suggestions you may have to make EWTN Radio even better. 205-795-5773. And thank you for listening to EWTN Radio.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. What did faith mean to Winston Churchill? Churchill was far from transparent about his religious beliefs and never regularly attended church services as an adult. He even considered himself not a pillar of the church, but a buttress, in the sense that he supported it, but from the outside. He was often described as anything from a God-haunted man to a stalwart non-believer. To talk with us about the life and faith of Winston Churchill is Gary Scott Smith, the author of many books, including Mark Twain, Preacher, Prophet, and Social Philosopher. Gary taught at Grove City College from 1978 to 2017, where he chaired the History Department and coordinated the Humanities Corps. His other books include Religion in the Oval Office, The Religious Lives of American Presidents, and the one we're talking about today, Duty and Destiny, The Life and Faith of Winston Churchill. Gary, great to have you in the program.
Thank you, Marcus. Pleasure to be with you.
So, in order to begin a dialogue about Winston Churchill, we need to paint a broader picture here about the fact that, for example, we have the anniversary of the storming of the beaches of Normandy, D-Day, and Churchill's role in rallying America to the Allied forces that essentially led to the cemented victory that we had over the Axis powers. So let's start there.
Well, certainly when World War II broke out and England was soon virtually fighting alone, Churchill appealed to his cousin in the faith, that is Anglican and Episcopalian, Franklin Roosevelt, America's president, trying to get Roosevelt to commit more resources and ultimately American troops to help England fight off the Nazi onslaught. I think we often forget as Americans how isolated and alone Britain was during the early World War II, and how subject they were to a potential invasion by the Nazi forces. So Churchill was did help convince Roosevelt to set up a land lease program that gave various supplies to Britain before America's involvement in the war, but he was ultimately unsuccessful in getting America to commit troops until Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, then we have a great collaborative relationship between FDR and Churchill, who spent 113 days together during the course of the war, had all kinds of letters and phone calls back and forth, and really forged a partnership, which I argue in the book is based in large part on their shared convictions, their shared faith, that helped them bring about the victory that culminated in D-Day and VE Day.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We can't forget VE Day in the conversation of D-Day as well. In fact, as we're talking about the friendship that blossomed between Churchill and Roosevelt, there's this good book, Franklin and Winston, by John Meacham, that listeners could be encouraged to look at as well, that shows a good portrait of the friendship that the two men shared from essentially with its seeds planted with the whole situation with World War II, but all the way until the end of their lives. So it really was a friendship that was initially forged in fire and enjoyed good pleasure toward the end. So starting from that then, we take a good look at Churchill's own life and his early history. He had father issues. He had a father who was absent and neglectful, but he looked up to him. He looked up to him dearly.
Well, absolutely. He more or less worshipped his father, Randolph, and was appalled by his death when Winston was a young man. And that was a blow to him. He saw himself following in his father's footsteps as a member of Parliament. But yes, his mother and father were both rather negligent parents, and a woman who was served as his nanny played a huge role in his life, and particularly in terms of shaping his faith and getting him to attend church and mm-hmm. talking about prayer and just this whole spiritual nourishment.
So this nanny, like you mentioned, planted those first inklings toward the faith. And to the end of his days, while Churchill never himself identified as a practicing member of the Church of England, in fact, in your book you highlight how he had real reservations against the Supreme Pontiff in Rome. Nonetheless, he did demonstrate a kind of affination for the work and the beliefs systems of especially the Church in England and Judeo-Christianity at large.
Well, absolutely. That the faith that was planted by his nanny, Elizabeth Ann Everest, was something that he more or less set aside and perhaps even rejected for a time when he was with the army in India, but certain life experiences while he was in the military and as a war correspondent rejuvenated his faith, rekindled his faith, brought him back to those early roots that he had. And all that definitely played a role in what we might call his worldview, his perspective on life. And certainly part of that perspective was that God is providential. He had seen it in his own life. He also recognized God's role in history. And one of the reasons that he argued repeatedly that the Nazis needed to be defeated was mm-hmm. because Judeo-Christian civilization needed to be preserved. And if the Nazis were victorious, that it would be the death blow to that Christian morality and Christian worship and the whole Christian civilization theme.
Right. In fact, he went on record to comment on the Great War, the First World War, and he said essentially the same thing about the Second World War, that these wars were nothing more than the clash of Christian civilization against scientific barbarism.
That's true. He saw a lot of parallels between Germany in World War One and World War Two, and the rise of communism and fascism, which he saw both as anti-God philosophies that needed to be defeated because of their view of humanity, their glorification of the state, their taking away basic human rights. So yes, he was quite concerned, and he wrote similar things about both what happened in World War One and what was happening in the build-up to World War Two and during the war.
He also had a real profound vitriol, I should say, for the concepts, let alone the regimes of socialism and communism. He saw them as inherently evil, and one of the main reasons why was he saw that in their totalitarian approach, the rights of the individual would be subjugated and eventually cast aside.
Absolutely true. I mean, he was definitely more negative toward Hitler than he was toward any German leaders during World War One. He repeatedly referred to Hitler as the devil. But nevertheless, he, as you say correctly, he had similar views of both wars and both regimes.
So going on to talk about World War II and its great impact, like you mentioned, for quite some time, the United Kingdom was alone in its combating of Nazi Germany and eventually the Axis powers. And so you get the Soviet forces taking the Eastern Front, and but from the West there really was no front. It was just a staving off of the powers as they attempted to sway as a wave to try to bring about a kind of global conquest. And it seemed like Britain was fighting what would ostensibly be a losing war, but because of not only Churchill's wisdom, but his eventual friendship with Roosevelt, it was a victory snatched from the claws of defeat.
Well, absolutely. I think any kind of outside objective observer would have thought that England was going to capitulate to the Nazis, either by way of conquest or way of some kind of compelled treaty, that they couldn't possibly stand on their own against the Nazi onslaught. Given the capacities of the two militaries, given the advancements that the Nazis had already made, the preparation that they had made so effectively for war, and back to the Soviet Union, you need to remember that, you know, until the ill-conceived Nazi invasion in summer of 1941, they were at least on paper an ally of Germany, at least not going to help Britain in any way.
Right.
So, and that's, Britain did stand very, very much alone. It did have its dominions, Canada, Australia, you know, lots of other countries, but that they had very little military capacity at that point.
Right. And so, like you said, Britain stood very much alone. And if I may read an excerpt from one of my favorite speeches from Winston Churchill. I'm going to stay away from doing my impression of him. He's a very quotable man, and the impression of whom is rather easy to do. I think anyone who hears a speech from him attempts to copy him. But you really get a sense of what seems to be the kind of thing that would lead lesser men to despair. And yet, here he is in 1940, rousing the entire nation to war, even though it might well result in their defeat. He's rousing them to war with the hope that, and he calls it the New World, that the United States would step forth and join them in arms. I'm going to read a small segment here. He says this: "We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island, or a large part of it, were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the New World, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old." He was just clinging on to hope. This was a man who was determined in his resolution because he knew that what he was fighting for was greater than the freedom of Britain. It was also the notion of democracy and elected government, and most of all, the dignity of the human person and therefore the liberty of the human person.
That's absolutely true. And it's a good reminder to us in our day and age with the challenges that we face in the world, that even in the darkest of days, Churchill had this firm conviction. Certainly, one of his greatest contributions was his oratory, his rhetoric, his ability to rouse the British people to fight in a way that few believed that they could. And certainly his views on God and Providence played a major role in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gary, we're going to continue this conversation with you. My guest, Gary Scott Smith, author of many books, including the one we're talking about today, Duty and Destiny, The Life and Faith of Winston Churchill, on this, the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the afternoon.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
A conversation I had several years ago with one of our listeners who wrote to me and said she was being challenged by a friend or a cousin or someone regarding the church and various teachings, especially on marriage and abortion and whatnot. And she said, I need the answers and I need them quickly because I want to quiet this person and shut them down. And I wrote her back and I said, I'm not going to give you the answers. I will give you some resources such as the link to the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And I said, but you need to look these up and you need to read them over and you need to learn them because this is not going to be the last time that you're going to be challenged or questioned about your faith. And what good is it if you're just barking answers to someone and you're not able to explain them charitably? This is a way we all should learn by doing the work ourselves.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern. On EWTN Radio.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
John 14. This is Jesus in the upper room with the disciples before he's going out to his sacrifice of himself for our salvation. And Philip says to the Lord, show us the Father and we'll be satisfied. Jesus looks at Philip and says, Philip, have I been with you all this time? Don't you understand? When you see me, you're looking at the Father. In fact, only two people throughout human history have given rise to the question, not who is he, but what is he? The two people are Buddha and Jesus. Buddha's answer was, don't come to me, don't look to me, look to my doctrine, look to what I teach. Jesus's answer was, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart. Jesus is explicitly claiming to be God.
Good afternoon, welcome to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Gary Scott Smith, author of Duty and Destiny, The Life and Faith of Winston Churchill. So Gary, we were talking earlier about Churchill's resolution to preserving Western civilization, the heritage essentially of Christendom. And he saw communism and he saw Nazi Germany especially as the great threat to that reality. It wasn't just a way of life that he was trying to preserve. He was essentially trying to preserve the dignity of the human person. And so he fought tooth and nail to that end.
That's certainly true. And in a day and age when we often talk about moral equivalency, and certainly that was not the view that Winston Churchill held. He talked repeatedly about this being a struggle of good versus evil, with the Allied powers on the side of good and the Axis powers on the side of evil, certainly recognizing that not everything that the Allies did was in more keeping with moral values. But generally speaking, he argued that it was a promoting of justice. It was a light versus darkness theme. So, yes, that was very central to the rhetoric that he used and the belief system he held.
Mm-hmm. And he was quite the imperialist as well, which is surprising to us. But his line of logic simply was to the effect that the great benefits of Western civilization were the necessary bedrock for the founding of truly free democratic societies. And so his sense of imperialism was driven by that notion.
Yes, he took a lot of criticism for his view that India wasn't ready yet for independence over against a lot of people in the 1930s, including Gandhi, who were arguing strongly that it was. But his basic argument was that until certain conditions existed in terms of levels of education and political participation, that the Indian people would not be able to govern themselves effectively. And that, of course, is an argument that's been used in more recent times about Afghanistan and Iraq and other places. You know, do you need certain preconditions for democracy to function effectively?
Right. And to some degree, he was rather prophetic about what would happen if Britain did, in fact, pull out of India. And one of the things he predicted was continuing ongoing bloodshed because of the lack of a clear, cohesive system of government and administration. And he also argued for a potential corruption at the level of government. And we are seeing that to some degree in India to this very day.
We are. Certainly the separation of Pakistan from India and the establishment of largely Hindu and largely Muslim countries helped. But currently, as you suggest, problems are rising in India with the persecution of Muslims and the attempt to create a more Hindu-oriented state there.
So how did Churchill view one of Nazi Germany's great pushes was the eradication of the Jewish people, and we'll never forget the Holocaust. What was Churchill's view of the Jewish people and his own take on the abhorrence of Nazi Germany?
Well, I think we need to remember that Churchill, like most other observers, during World War II, did not understand the full scope of the horrors of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
Roosevelt didn't. I'm not sure that anybody did until the liberation of the camps in the early 1945 and into the rest of that calendar year. But to the extent that he understood it, he opposed it strongly. He had a lot of Jewish friends in his lifetime, and he certainly was a friend to Jewish leaders, many of whom looked very fondly upon Churchill. So he was, again, he can be faulted along, well, I'm not sure he can be faulted personally because he didn't become prime minister until May of 1940.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, England and the United States can both be faulted for not taking in nearly as many Jewish refugees as in hindsight, which we would say they should have done. But nevertheless, I would argue that he was certainly a friend to Israel when it became established as a nation in 1948, along with Harry Truman, and that he was appalled by what the persecution of Jews in Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm. And so, as he's going through this, as you mentioned, he didn't quite have a concept of the sheer extent of Nazi Germany's abhorrent acts against individuals, experimentation, the concentration camps and whatnot. But whatever little he knew, however, was an affront against his sensibilities, because he saw the documents, for example, like the Magna Carta, the American Declaration of Independence and its Constitution, the Bill of Rights, all of these he saw as an overflow of the bedrock of Christian civilization. And anything that came as an affront to that was, in his mind, an affront against Christian civilization itself.
Well, absolutely. And I argue in my book, citing a scholar named Richard Langworth, that when he used the phrase Christian civilization, it really to him included Jews, Buddhists, Muslims. So it was a very encompassing view. It was basically a view of universal moral principles
mm-hmm.
that could be derived from all the world's main religious traditions. So it was kind of a strange view of Christian civilization in that sense, but he recognized that there were some affinities between Christian faith and other major world religions, and that was the core, those are the core principles that he wanted to preserve, and he thought the Nazis were out to destroy.
So in the face of all of this, then, Britain at this point is fighting what is ostensibly a losing war. Free Europe seems to be aligning themselves more with the Axis powers rather than with the Allied forces. And so Britain appeals to the United States for aid, military aid. In the face of all of this, then, we've got the groundwork set up for what eventually leads to Normandy and D-Day. So what were Churchill's sentiments and his contributions toward that?
Well, Stalin was very much concerned about a second front to try to alleviate the pressure that the Nazis were exerting upon them in their invasion of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And so that second front essentially became Northern Africa and then Sicily and Italy. And there was a give and take and a back and forth between Roosevelt and Churchill over what the second front should be, what the priorities should be. Of course, the United States is also very much involved in fighting against Japan in the Pacific. And we're not going to throw all our resources into the Mediterranean sphere and into what's going on in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So at times, it's kind of ironic, at times Churchill was much more aggressive about the timetable for the invasion of Normandy, and the other times FDR was more aggressive about when it should occur. But eventually they settled upon the fact that May of 1944 was probably the earliest that they could bring it about in terms of actually having the troops ready, in terms of having the facade set up, the subterfuge, so that the Nazis think the invasion is coming from somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
you know, the time or the place. So all of that plays a significant role. And then, of course, Churchill yields to Roosevelt in allowing Eisenhower to be the supreme commander of the Allied forces and be the one who determines when the invasion is going to ultimately occur. And then, of course, that is affected by weather. I give Eisenhower's faith, I think, plays a significant role in all these matters. He would later say, if nothing else in my life proved the existence of an almighty merciful God, it was the fact that the weather cleared up and we were able to go on June the 6th after June the 5th being a wipeout weather-wise. And he said that gives you the courage to make, your faith gives you the courage to make decisions you must make in a crisis and then the confidence to leave the result to a higher power. So, you know, Eisenhower's faith, like that of Roosevelt and a little bit less to the extent of Churchill's, I think were significant. One interesting thing was that Churchill really wanted to go as part of the invasion of Normandy. He wanted to go on the HMS Belfast, and he was bound and determined he was going to do it. And finally, the English king, who was trying strongly to dissuade him from doing it, said, "All right, if you're going to go, I'm going to go." And that basically led Churchill to back off and say, "Hey, I'm not going to go." But let's see, June 13th, I believe it was, that Churchill did go over to France. So only 7 days after the invasion, he makes a trip. And during the war, Churchill traveled something like 110,000 miles, and he was a lot of war zones. He was across the Atlantic numerous times. He was not a fearless man. He was a fearless man. Mm-hmm. He was willing to put his life on the line, even despite his importance to the British people, because he believed God was protecting him, and he believed it was important for the British people for him to be in certain settings and mm-hmm. do certain. Of course, he's also very well known for, during the Blitz, going out into dangerous situations
right.
that remain air raid sanctuaries.
It's very clear that he was very moved by the loss of life of his people. I mean, we have records of about 384,000 British troops dying and about 400,000 United States soldiers dying during the entire conflict of World War II. Now, these numbers are roughly similar. However, when you think about proportionality of the sheer number of people in each of these nations, Britain suffered a statistically heavier loss. And it was very clear that Churchill took that, not so much personally, but he took that responsibly.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we talk about D-Day, we probably think a lot more about FDR from the perspective that he had this six-minute D-Day prayer that a lot of people have read. If you haven't, you can read it online. It's well worth reading, and expresses kind of the core convictions that Roosevelt held. We don't hear quite as much about what was going on in Churchill's mind and what he was thinking. Let me quote from a speech that he gave on D-Day to the House of Commons. He said, "So far as the commanders who are engaged report that everything is proceeding according to plan. And what a plan. This vast operation is undoubtedly the most complicated and difficult that has ever occurred. It involves tides, wind, waves, visibility, both from the air and the sea standpoint. And the combined employment of land, air, and sea forces in the highest degree of intimacy and in contact with conditions which could not and cannot be fully foreseen." So, again, he testified to the difficulty in making the decision, the difficulty of the operation, and the courage of the people who went forth from Canada, America, and Britain to land on the shores of Normandy. And I think Saving Private Ryan really has brought that picture to the forefront for mm-hmm. the people who've seen that movie, how awful it was.
Yeah, my colleague Brian Shanley showed me the movie. I hadn't watched it prior to yesterday, actually, and it's a very sobering depiction that's rather realistic of the events at Normandy, particularly Omaha Beach. My guest, Gary Scott Smith, author of Duty and Destiny, The Life and Faith of Winston Churchill. Stay tuned as we round off this hour. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
The Encounter Conference, June 26th through the 28th at the New Glass City Center in Toledo, Ohio. 15 powerful speakers.
It is the encounter with the Holy Spirit that makes Jesus come alive and gives us the courage and the wisdom to go forth and to even risk our own lives.
Everyone pretty much says the miracles that Jesus did are real. The miracles that the early church did are real.
As often as the popes are talking about the new evangelization, they're also saying we need to pray for a new Pentecost. We need to return to the upper room. Encounter represents the church returning to the upper room. As we're coming boldly before God and asking Him to renew that Pentecostal fire for the strength, the gifts, and the wisdom to be able to preach Jesus to a lost and broken world, so that we can become fully alive in Him, so that the world may come to believe that Jesus is the one whom God sent.
Register today at EncounterConference.org. That's EncounterConference.org.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What's looking back at you at age 22? What do you hope to say about that child at age 22? If you're content to say, well, the way kids are turning out nowadays, counting my blessings. Parole officer says one of the nicest children he has. Or would you rather say he's one in 100? Morals, compassion, seeks God. Are you prepared to be a 1 in 100 parent then? You can't parent like the bulk of parents anymore. You will supervise far higher. You will screen out toxic media sewage at a rate unlike all of your friends, perhaps your family. No guarantees as to what we'll be looking back at you at age 22. But you want to be able to say, I think he's 1 in 100. Then you be a 1 in 100 parent.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'd like to first announce that in the World Championship of Cricket, the United States beat Pakistan. And I really want to put that out there. As a member of the British Commonwealth, former member of the British Commonwealth, I grew up with people who played cricket, never quite understood the game. But I love that the United States has triumphed. No military conflict in human history matches the magnitude of the loss of life due to World War II. The liberties in our nation, our blessed nation, have been bought with a price. If the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, then the blood of the patriots is the seed of our free nation. In a 1787 letter to William Stephen Smith, the son-in-law of John Adams, Thomas Jefferson said, "What country can preserve its liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? The tree of liberty must be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants." Until next time, I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.